but even in the structure that God had originally put into place for the nuclear family. I can't help but think that part of this is the toll that society is paying for the destruction of the family unit. There's so many that don't know who they are. They just don't know who they are. And you think to prove something, to be something, they have to make some great statement or, you know, shocking deed to show who they are. It's lostness. It's lostness of personal identity. It's a disconnect from a tradition. And it's sad. And all the talk about what the problems are, you know, in society, the one thing you almost never hear is, what about the loss of the traditional family home? There's some voices about that, but very, in general, it's not there. Never going to deal with that problem. Because society in general, across the world, especially Western culture, is set on destroying the traditional family. And all the things that are happening are part of that. We have a tremendous opportunity. We have a tremendous blessing. We think about this in our own lives, that we can preserve, we can hold up the original intention that God had for the traditional, we say the traditional family unit. This morning we'd like to look at the use and misuse of tradition in preserving the faith. We're probably going to be mostly looking at it from the positive side, and maybe at a later time look at the misuse of tradition, so bear with me. I'm going to be giving the one side this morning. In relation to the positive use of tradition in preserving the faith, and also in relation to identity, that's going to be part of it as well. I know there are a lot of thoughts and feelings associated when we talk about tradition, and a lot of viewpoints. And I do think that this subject this morning is also connected to our age, at least in how we view it. I would say in general, this is a general statement, but that the older a person gets, in general, the more appreciation they have for tradition. And this is not to speak disparagingly of our youth, but I would say that it's also true, and you can see this in the scriptures as well and throughout history, that younger people, youth, have a struggle understanding tradition in the place of it. I think that's just, you know, those are, it's just an overview, a general statement, but I think that there's much evidence to prove that. And so I would like us to keep open minds this morning and understand, endeavor to understand this and what happens when there's a loss of identity, and then also with that is the loss of appreciation for good tradition. Now, because we're not looking at it this morning, maybe I'll say it here, maybe for another message, but there's a lot of hurts, and there's a lot of pain, and there's a lot of lostness that happens through tradition. Not near all tradition is good, and I just want to say that. Even though we're going to be looking more at the positive side, there is a side to it that is very destructive. And I would like, by the grace of God, in a future message, to look at how can we rightly analyze tradition and make right decisions about tradition, because I think that's an important part of moving forward in life. Now, the theme verse for this series of messages, Colossians 2 and verse 8, we've looked at this every time we've been on this subject. Beware lest any man spoil you through philosophy and vain deceit, after the tradition of men, after the rudiments of the world, and not after Christ. And I think that verse is pointing out the danger, the error of human philosophy and the deceit that is in there, and then also the traditions of men and that are not after Christ. And so this morning, I certainly understand that warning. Now, the question, what is a tradition? I was tempted to ask you if you have a, in general, when you think of tradition, do you have a more negative mindset toward it or a positive? But I decided I'm not going to ask you that. I would say for myself, there's a tendency to swing a little bit, I think for me, to swing a little bit more to the negative about it than the positive. And I've, through studying for this, I've been just trying to analyze my own heart, why I feel that way. And I'm not sure that I'm satisfied with the way I feel about it, because I don't know if I understand it. I was blessed, I'll say it this way, I was blessed in looking at the positive side of tradition in getting ready for this message. Now, what is tradition? It is a belief, principle, custom, or behavior with symbolic meaning or special significance. Maybe I'll say more about that later. But it's a special significance that people in a particular group or society have continued to follow for a long time, often being handed down from one generation to the next. So it's something that is done repetitiously. A principle, belief, custom, behavior has symbolic meaning, and it's handed down from one generation to the next. Now, it's interesting that it's derived from the Latin verb, which in English would be traitor. A traitor, meaning to transmit or hand over, to give for safekeeping, someone that trades. And so one generation to the next generation is, they're like a traitor. They're transmitting, they're handing over something for safekeeping to the next generation. Now, tradition also is, you can say, regular behaviors or actions that we engage in over and over again at the same time and often in the same way. We are creatures of habit. We just are. Whether in personal life or in family life, in general, we're creatures of habit. And there are certain ways we do things, and we don't give a lot of thought to it. We just do it that way because we're comfortable with the way we do it, and that's how it is. That's related to the idea of tradition, not necessarily the full explanation for it, but it is part of it. And so I think we understand that in relation to tradition. We're going to be looking at the scriptures that portray this as well, but I had to think of various aspects of tradition, and we could go into the Old Testament and look at the Jewish law and how God gave the Ten Commandments. He gave the laws of clean and unclean and all those things to Israel. And they were God's commandments to them. But then the outworking of that is that the Jews, is right up to the time of Jesus' day, had added so many things, so many details of how this law was meant to be lived out. And so there was so many applications to this and the traditions. And so, and we're going to be looking at that more probably in the next message in relation to the negative side. But Jesus was really hard on the Pharisees in keeping all those little details, and he called them traditions. You remember the one time that they chided Jesus, or they spoke against Jesus to his disciples. They said to his disciples, "Doesn't your master wash his hands before he eats?" Now, we know it's a good idea to wash your hands before you eat. That's okay. But what they had incorporated that into their law, and in fact, it was almost more than a tradition. I mean, it was like, you don't eat before you wash your hands. You're unclean. You're defiling. And so that's an illustration. Of course, Jesus many times took that teaching and turned it around, and said, well, you ought to be more concerned about your heart. than about your hands. You know, and so all those things that were related to this idea of a tradition and how it was viewed. But in thinking of tradition and the fact that we are creatures of habit, like I said, and there's all aspects of this in life, it means that no one can escape tradition, no matter how hard they try. I don't think anybody can really escape tradition for very long, because what will happen is they end up just either joining another set of traditions that are different from what they were running away from, or they develop their own set of traditions. You're not going to escape it, in other words. An illustration, maybe it's not a good illustration, but I believe it was in 1974. Loblaw, one of the biggest grocery chains in Canada, come up with a new marketing scheme. And that is, they developed this marketing brand called No Name Brand. So the idea was simplify their advertising, simplify their packaging. Instead of, you know, the old traditional way of the Kraft brand or the whatever all the brands are, but instead of, you know, marketing under all these different brands who have promoted themselves for years and years and years and been around for a long time, they decided to develop their own brand, and it was a no-name brand, and they got a lot of suppliers who had their own brands to buy into this scheme, marketing scheme, and that's what you have today. Like, so it was, yellow was chosen for the basic color of packaging. I think the print is red and white. And that was all part of their research into the right color to sell things and all of that. There's a lot of science, supposedly science, goes into that. But tremendously successful. So what happens when you drop all your traditional brand names and come up with this no-name brand? It becomes a brand in itself, you see? Now, that's just an illustration in relation to tradition. You know, people can say, well, I'm going to leave this tradition, I'm going to throw out this tradition, but really, at the end of the day, you're going to have a tradition of some kind. You're going to be following something. We'll probably talk more about later time, Lord willing. In our fast-paced and ever-changing lives, you know, and living in a world of change that appears in constant turmoil, traditions are more important than ever before. And I believe there's a grounding part of this. Another thing to think about is that history is full of tradition, really. When you think about, you read, say, like through the Old Testament, there's a lot of tradition comes out there. And much of it good. Maybe not all of it, but a lot of it good. Now, we want to look at it from the biblical context and then more at the positive aspect of tradition. So what does the Bible teach about tradition? I'm going to look at a few examples here. Deuteronomy 6:6-9, we're not going to turn to this one. We've looked at it several times in previous messages. But think about the idea of tradition now, where Moses is writing the words of God, and these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart. Thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children. Thou shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up, and thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thine hand, and they shall be as frontlets between thine eyes, and thou shalt write them upon the posts of thy house and on thy gates. Now, God is commanding that this is how you're to teach your children. This is where you do it, when you do it, how you do it. But in that, there's no doubt in that there is going to be traditions developed very quickly in the outworking of those principles. You know, do you read the Bible stories, you know, before you go to bed to the children? When do you have family devotions? You know, when do you have, you know, personal devotions? All those things. I'm just using that as an illustration. But at some point, you're going to have to develop this and say, okay, well, this is the structure that we're going to live by to fulfill these teachings. And so what I'm saying is tradition is inevitable in relation to the framework of transmitting the faith. Now, turn with me to Jeremiah 35. And this is, and you're familiar with this story. This is the story of the Rechabites. And we're not going to go into this, and it'd be a whole message or so in itself. But remember this story, where here in chapter 35 of Jeremiah, Jeremiah was told by the Lord to bring the children of Rechab into the house of the Lord and set wine before them and tell them to drink this wine. Now think about this. The prophet of God, Jeremiah, bringing these men into the house of the Lord and putting wine in front of them and say, here, take a drink. They said, oh, no, we can't do that. We have that in verse 5. And I set before the sons of the house of the Rechabites pots full of wine and cups, and I said unto them, drink ye wine. But they said, we will drink no wine, for Jonadab, the son of Rechab, our father, commanded us, saying, ye shall drink no wine, neither ye nor your sons forever. And it goes on to talk about some of the other things they were told not to do. Now, this was the spiritual level in Judah at this time was deplorable. And Jeremiah was the lone prophet of God speaking against the evils of Israel and Judah and prophesying of the destruction that was going to happen. And here God used this unique family of the Kenites for an object lesson, because in a few short years, Nebuchadnezzar was going to bring his army against Jerusalem and level a city. Now, we could go back and look at 2 Kings 10, where we have the first mention of Jonadab and his zeal in purging the house of Ahab. And also in 2 Kings 10, later in verses 17 and 23, he was a strong defender of true worship in Israel. So he was a man of God. Jonadab was a man that had a vision. And at some point, he commanded his family to sustain the life of a nomad rather than assimilate with the rest of Israel and Judah. And what is interesting is that his charge to them, and what he said, this is what I want you to do. He really established a family tradition. And the family tradition was that you don't live in a house, you live in a tent. You don't stay at one place, you don't live in the city, you live out in the country, in the desert more. And you don't drink wine. You just do not drink wine. And he established this as a strong family tradition because of his vision of what was going to be needed. And it's interesting that this family, now in Jeremiah 35, that's 300 years from when Jonadab said, don't do this. From what I understand in the context, 300 years, these men said, no, this is our family. In other words, this is our family tradition. We don't do that. Now, it shows you the positive effect. And God blessed them. I mean, they disobeyed the prophet when the prophet told them to do this. They said, no, we're not going to do it because we've never done it. Our fathers never did it. And we're not going to do it either. Verse 18, and Jeremiah said unto the house of the Rechabites, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, because ye have obeyed the commandment of Jonadab your father and kept all his precepts and done according to all that he hath commanded you. Therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, Jonadab the son of Rechab shall not want a man to stand before me forever. There's always going to be a faithful remnant of this family. Wondered who they were today. I'm not sure where those descendants are today. It'd be interesting to know that. But God said there's going to always be a faithful descendant of that family. You see the power, the positive power of tradition? They had come to the city at this point in Jeremiah because they were uncomfortable with it, but they came because they knew that Nebuchadnezzar was coming. They believed the prophet Jeremiah that the Jerusalem was going to fall. And they came for a little more security. But they did not build a house. They did not. They still kept their way of life. Now, this just shows the power of tradition in maintaining a position that God could bless. you know, in that setting, in that situation, in that culture, it was powerful. And as they followed it, God could bless them. Not just because they obeyed the voice of Jonadab, but because they preserved the faith in their family when all the rest of Israel, or most of the rest of Israel, had apostatized and left the faithful living for God. But this family held that. That is interesting. These men are examples of vision and steadfastness and conviction. And of course, the question is, how was this charge that was given to this family preserved unwaveringly for 300 years? All right, let's now think about another example. We're not going to turn to this one. We referred to this one in some of the previous messages in relation to tradition, identity, and culture. But Daniel, as a captive in the land of Babylon, as a young man, Jewish tradition has him at about 17 years old when he was carried away captive into Babylon. He was a prince. In other words, he was from the royal family. He served in the royal court there in Jerusalem, but he was carried away to Babylon. A young man, very young, in a very heathen culture, a very sensual culture. It was the Babylon would have been at its zenith of wealth and sensuality and power at this time. He was chosen then to, because of his abilities, his wisdom, his trainability, he was chosen to be one who was to be prepared to serve in the presence of the king. And we remember the story. They were given several years, I think it was 3 years, of training and all the things to assimilate them into the culture. Their name was changed. Instead of being called Daniel, he was called Belteshazzar. He was given a heathen, Babylonian name. So they tried to change his identity of who he was. And it was all an attempt to assimilate him into the culture around him. There was a lot of young men taken at this time. We only know, or the Bible only names a few of them. We have his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that were also part of the carrying away. But there was many of them. Do you know the names of the rest of them, besides those four I just mentioned? No. What happened to them? They lost their identity, and they were assimilated because of then also giving up their tradition, and they were assimilated into the culture of Babylon. You take the situation where the king had made that great image, and they were to fall down and worship it. Daniel was in a different position, apparently, at that time. But you know, it was a test for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And as far as we know, they were the only three that were willing to maintain their identity. They maintained their tradition in relation to serving God, not bowing to a graven image. And in the midst of a culture of thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of men all around them that had dropped to their knees in response to the king. Think about that. Now, what did they do? And you know, backing up a little bit in that story, when they were told that they're going to be eating off the king's table every day, Daniel had to make a decision. And if he had not made that decision, I believe, at that time, rightly, it would have been a slide into the culture of Babylon. But it's interesting that he right away drew a line and said, well, you know, please don't make us eat this food off the king's table. Just give us vegetables and water. And you remember how the king's servant, he said, well, you're going to endanger my head to the king because I have a responsibility to get you ready to stand in the presence of the king. And you remember, Daniel said, just give us 10 days, and I will prove that this is going to work. And it did. It was a miracle. And at the end of those, was it 10 days or 7 days? But at the end of that time, it says that those young men, those four young men, appeared healthier. You could say they were in prime health, even better than those who ate from the king's table. Now, well, what Daniel did was, it's subtle in the sense that he drew a line in saying, here's a line that I'm going to draw. And it may not even have been in relation to eating pork or whatever else that would have been forbidden to a Jew. It may have included that idea. I'm not sure. But the fact was, he just drew that line. He didn't even drink the wine. He said, we want water to drink. And drawing that line helped to keep that separation in who they were, their identity. It preserved their identity, that they were different. They just didn't fall into what society offered in Babylon, and even what the king wanted them to do. It also then, in relation to tradition, you know, harking back to all the commandments that God gave in relation to eating, and the clean and the unclean. So they held that one. And with that, then it preserved them in a heathen culture, you see. You see the connection of the three. And it's interesting that you have to get to the end of the book of Daniel, and Daniel is still one of those children of the captivity. Remember, he was an old man when he got called there, when the handwriting was on the wall. We think he might have been almost 80 years old at that time. And he was still called that. He was still one of those children of the captivity. He kept that identity all the way through. You take when he was tested with that, the idea there of making a prayer, a request to the king. And that they were only supposed to, for 30 days, they were to pray to no God, but to only the king of Babylon. And Daniel knew that the writing was signed. He knew there was a death warrant for anyone that disobeyed this. What did he do? He went into his chamber, opened the window toward the temple. He kneeled down and prayed 3 times, like he always did. You see the power of tradition? He can preserve his identity. He preserved his tradition, and it saved him from the culture. And you get to the end of the book of Daniel. He was an old man, faithful. He served God all those years in Babylon. I think it's just a really powerful story that we need to understand today in our lives, and what it takes for us to not be assimilated into the culture. You could say the false Babylonian culture of our day. Second Thessalonians 2:15, therefore, brethren, stand fast and hold the traditions which ye have been taught, whether by word or our epistle. So Paul is there saying that to stand fast, hold the traditions. Now, the word traditions, as is used in that verse, is really like the traditions or the teachings of that were given to them, or of the law, or of the apostles. So it's what was handed down to them, spiritual traditions, in that sense. And that's what Paul is saying, to keep those traditions which ye have been taught. Now, I'd like for a bit to think about, what is the positive place of tradition in our lives? Again, we'll be looking at the other side of this in the near future, Lord willing, but what is the positive place of tradition in our lives? Why should we appreciate tradition when it works the way God intends it to work? Well, traditions offer constancy, or consistency, we could say, stability, familiarity, and a semblance of order and predictability in our existence. I thought about this morning, you know, with this service. You know, we come to a service here, and the way we have a Sunday morning service is not the only way to have a Sunday morning service. There's other ways to do it, probably. But, you know, there's a certain level of tradition that goes into our Sunday morning worship services. The brothers sit on this side, the sisters sit on that side. Is there other ways to do it? Probably. Sure there is. Tradition. So, we normally open with singing a couple songs. Is that the only way to do it? No. It's a tradition. We've done it that way. We grew up with it that way, most of us. We have a devotional. And then we usually have a prayer. A lot of those prayers are kneeling prayers. That's a tradition. It's not the only way to pray, but it's a good way to pray. And you go down the list, you know, we have Sunday school, and we, you know, and then we have usually a message and preaching. And we have closing comments and announcements, and we close the service. Now, think of it this way. And again, that's not the only way to have church, but that's normally how we do a Sunday morning service. Now, what would happen if it would be totally, if you take, say, tradition right out of that completely? And when we come here, it just would be whatever is decided in by whim or wish that regardless how it lasts, whether we sing songs or not sing songs or how you do it, you know. And it's interesting that Paul even talks about this in relation to the Corinthian church, where they seem to have some of this idea that it's just like let it open-ended and just whatever happens, happens. I had a friend years ago that was attending a church where they tried to be a little more innovative and progressive, I guess, and they just left it up to whatever happened, happened. And he said, I just can't handle this. He was telling me one morning, he said, you just don't know what's going to happen next. He said, this guy got up and started talking about fixing his washing machine. And he said, I don't know what that had to do with the service. And he said, it was just totally chaotic. He said, he's just like, it was, and this man would have come from a German background, like high German background, and used to very methodical, you know, European ways of doing things. And he said, this is awful. We take some of this for granted in relation to good tradition, you know, and how much more worshipful is it to be able to come to church and, you know, you sit here, you know, and you know you're going to be singing a song or two or three, and you can just concentrate on the worship. You don't have to be wondering what is going to happen next, right? So I'm just using that as an illustration. But it's not wrong to change some things, you know, times. We discuss it, say, well, let's maybe do this. Change this aspect or that aspect. It's not wrong to change. It's not the traditions lock us in 100%. It shouldn't necessarily. But what I'm saying is that we can worship a lot better when there's some form, when there's some structure, when there's some tradition, because you know what to expect. Now, you take like the spirit leading, I think, you know, there's different ways that is done, even in our services. I do think sometimes that we could loosen up a little more and give audible agreement or say amen or, you know, and there's times that definitely, you know, different brethren share. But I do think that we have to be, there's a sense in which we should appreciate, you know, the positive aspect, the constancy, the stability, the familiarity, the semblance of order and predictability, you know, that brings to us. This gives us a sense of belonging and makes us feel safe and secure. There's that aspect of tradition. and versus a chaotic, confusing situation. Traditions also represent a critical piece of our identity and our culture. We've been crisscrossing this idea, but traditions do represent a critical piece of our identity and culture. And that is important. They help form the structure and foundation of our families and our society. Go into another completely different culture and see how you feel so much of a misfit, because you can't identify with their traditions, you see. I think of this sometimes in reading the story that Jesus told there of the 10 virgins. You know, and the whole idea of there that, you know, the 5 that were wise and the 5 that were foolish, and to try to understand the traditions and the culture of that story, you see. So there's a lot of tradition involved in that. You go into other countries, and I remember the first time I was in Guatemala, and we were visiting around in the community, the villages there, and everywhere you went, you were just helped. You just sit down. You were almost like put in your chair. I mean, and then you were, you know, before very long, you were given a cup of coffee. And if it was in someone that had a little bit more advantages in life, it was a good cup of coffee. And if it was a really poor home, you ended up with the poor coffee, which was the corn leaves that were roasted and burnt to a crisp and then ground up, and they made coffee out of that. I can still remember the taste of that. It wasn't necessarily a bad taste, but it was sure something I never had tasted before. But very traditional, you know, it's part of that culture. It's the way they treat it. And you drank your coffee. You didn't say, and you don't refuse coffee. You have to take it. It would be a slam to them to refuse their coffee. Again, it's cultural. It's difference. It's a tradition. But for anyone involved in that, they would feel very comfortable with that because they're at home with that. The same as we're quite at home with our culture, our traditions here. Traditions also remind us that we are part of a history that defines our past. Tradition helps us to remember that we are part of a history that defines our past, shapes who we are today, and who we are likely to become. So it's that link with our past. Someone that has that completely severed is in a really tough position because, again, it affects their identity. When they really have no idea of who their family is or understand, you know, that connection with their history, it affects their identity struggle. And also, if we ignore the meaning of good tradition, we're in danger of damaging the underpinning of our identity. I think that's easy to understand. Tradition also can help us avoid the strong tendency toward a generation gap. We refer to a generation gap, it's like the older versus the younger. And when there's a generation gap, there's a breakdown of communication, and the younger are not listening and valuing, you know, the teaching and the traditions of the older. And the older then have a tendency to not understand and the what's wrong with the younger. It can be a generation gap, and every generation has had to deal with this. It is interesting, I found this in my studies. Psychology has found that children who have an intimate knowledge of their family's history are typically more well-adjusted and self-confident than children who don't. Interesting. I think there's some truth to that, though, because I've known people who did not have a knowledge of their family history, and they struggled with who they were. There's something about understanding your past and knowing you belong to something bigger that inspires confidence in children. I think that, again, it means that who are we holding before our children as their heroes? I'm thankful for what was given to me in my young years in relation to history, especially Anabaptist history, and men who I grew up looking up to. In fact, I know there was a stage of life, I'm not sure exactly how old I was, that I wanted to be a martyr. Because I had read the stories of Michael Sadler, especially, was my hero. As a boy, I read that story. It's never left me. I can't say in my life, this stage of life, I necessarily would seek to be a martyr. But if that God calls me to that, that's how it would be. But do you understand what I'm saying is, who do our children have for their heroes? You know the story of Michael Sadler, one of the strongest apologetics in his day for the Schleitheim Confession of Faith, is largely written by him. And when he went to his death, him and his wife was drowned, he was burnt to the stake. He was a minister. He told his congregation, he sent word out to his congregation. He said, I'm going to give you a sign from the fire to let you know that a martyr's death is bearable. And when the ropes were burned off his hands, he raised his hand to his congregation, those who were watching, as a testimony for them that a martyr's death was bearable. That story is a tradition. It reaches all the way down to us today and given to us from a man who was faithful unto death. Tradition also brings order and predictability to life. We are creatures of habit. I talked about this before, and another message that talked about our Creator is a God of order and predictability in His creation. And you could say, well, that's not really tradition, and yet it continually happens. The sun just comes up and goes down, and the seasons of the year, overall, they're predictable. Visiting last evening with a brother, and he was telling me that so there's somebody in town here that keeps track of all the rainfall and temperatures for the last many years here in the valley. And he totals them up, and the averages, and it's only a few degrees difference for all the years. You know, we're having a late spring right now. We think this is highly unusual, but this man says from his data, it all finally evens out. By the time you get to the end of the year, it's all within just a couple degrees of the median. So that's interesting. So God is predictable. In Genesis 8:22, while the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest, and cold and heat, and summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease. I wish all the environmentalists would believe that verse. God is predictable. I mean, it's like, what are we worrying about? Like, what? God is a God of order. He created His creation with good order, and we all function best when we have order in our lives. Here's another interesting verse, 1 Corinthians 14:33. Paul here was talking to the Corinthian church, and I referred to this earlier about the confusion that they had, and the way they were having church was just not very good. Anyway, then, so Paul here says at the end of his little discourse about this, he says, for God is not the author of confusion, but a peace. So you think about that in relation to tradition. God is not the author of confusion. It's not all chaotic, but there's order to it. And I think we also need to remember that chaos and confusion are a result of the curse of sin in this world and the work of the devil to disrupt the divine order that God created, you see. And whether that's in family life, like we talked about, you know, in marriages, And you go down the list, the order that God created and the way he wants it to function. Tradition is necessary to transmit values. It's almost impossible, I believe, to teach and pass on the faith to the next generation without the use of tradition. The illustration of this, just think about this. A little child who's used to coming to church Sunday mornings. This is part of life. They get older, they go to Sunday school. When they're playing together and they're playing church, does tradition have any part of them mimicking us when they're playing church? That's an illustration of what I'm saying in relation to the power of tradition in teaching and transmitting. They want to mimic, they want to follow, because they know this is how we do at church, and they're going to try and copy that. So I believe it is almost impossible to teach and pass on the faith without the use of tradition. Recently visiting with someone who was telling us about their son who was with a church group who believed that no church standards are needed for the church. Since everyone is spirit-led, we don't need to have any church standards. Everyone is spirit-led. That's a nice idea, and I wish it would work. But has this tradition been tried before? Yes. Does history tell us anything about how this tradition, as it relates to church life, works out? Yes. I'm just surprised that anybody wouldn't want to try it again because it's been tried so many times. And at best, it lasts one generation. Because it does not have that grounding of tradition to pass it on. And it flies apart. So history shows us that that doesn't work. That's the illustration again. Tradition can be a guide in stability in the midst of a world of change. And really, tradition can help us analyze change. Because if you've been doing something the same for a period of time, and there was a reason for it, and now change comes along and says, let's throw this tradition out. Let's throw all these traditions out. You see, tradition then will help us to analyze change because it says, well, we've done it this way. Is there a reason? And so I'm not saying whether good or bad. I'm just saying that it can help us identify change and the spirit of change. We're going to look at another time at how we need to look at that and make a change. Tradition can contribute to group cohesion through identity and practice. We talked about a Sunday morning worship service, and I thought about a few other things. You know, traditions can be made, new ones can be made. When our group started 11 years ago, we started having fellowship meals. I'm not sure. Did we do it every Sunday at first or almost every Sunday? That got to be a little much. Okay, well, we backed off on that. We felt like orphans, of course. But then I think we settled on once a month. Maybe we did it twice a month even for a little bit and then went to once a month. But I gather that, and I would share the same, that it's a tradition we don't want to drop, right? We were at Grassland last Sunday morning, and it was interesting. A tradition that they had started when they formed their congregation was that at the end of the service, they would have coffee together. And I kind of forgot about it, and we were there, and after the service, some of the young girls brought a tray around and served a cup of coffee to everybody that wanted it. It's a tradition that they had started, and it had never stopped. It was... relaxing, especially with the visitors that were there from the community, and have a cup of coffee. Whether we need to do that, no, probably not, or I guess whatever you decide. But I'm just saying, but it was a tradition, and they kept doing it that way. So, but there is a certain way in which traditions then contribute to group cohesion through identity and practice. I talked about fellowship meals, communion services. Is there other ways to have communion services? Sure. The Bible gives us some direction, but not all the details of it. But again, you don't have to come into a communion service wondering, you know, what's going to happen now? Do this first or last, you know, or last? Or no, you can concentrate and you can worship. And we're all on the same page because we know pretty well what to expect, right? So it brings that cohesion and coming together and identity. Talk about marriage ceremonies and just a lot of things like that in relation to church life you could talk about. That there's a lot of tradition that goes into that. But again, it can bring that cohesion. Tradition can also help to preserve meaning in life. This is more of a general thought. We all gravitate and appreciate predictable behavior. I don't know of anybody here that would say you appreciate unpredictable behavior. And so you think about tradition then, in general, it helps to preserve meaning in life. Traditions are a way to showcase role models and also to showcase, you can say, what is important. And whether it's parents, I remember how serious it was for us to be late for church Sunday morning. I mean, that was, my father was a stickler on that you are not late for church. And I suppose it has affected me now. I don't know if I hold it maybe as tight as he did in a way, but I don't like being late for church. It's a tradition. It's what I grew up with. I'm comfortable with that. You know, where that's not a tradition, then it doesn't matter to people so much. But I'm just using that as an illustration. And there's a lot of things, you know, that impact that. Now, in closing, again, none of us can escape tradition, one way or the other. But the question is, and we want to look at going forward, is how can we be sure traditions are working for us and not working against us? That's a question that we need to look at. Or right with that, how do we discern when a tradition is helping us or when it is not helping us? Lord willing, we want to continue this while looking at what happens when tradition works against us and how can we understand that. 2 Timothy 1:5, I'll just close with this verse. When I call to remembrance the unfeigned faith that is in thee, which dwelt first in thy grandmother Lois and thy mother Eunice, and I am persuaded that in thee also. You think about that verse. Identity, tradition, and culture. The passing on of something that was valuable down to Timothy because it was valued and respected. May God bless us as we continue to seek God and understand how we live out our lives and the effects of our lives, not only in relation to our own spiritual life, but also with our families and our community and our church. God would help us. Let's kneel to pray. Father, we thank you for your guidance. We thank you for your love. We thank you for your mercy in our lives. We thank you for the Lord Jesus. We thank you for his teaching in so many ways which we can understand and know your purposes for us. We thank you for the stories, the examples in the scriptures of your people, your saints who have gone before, who have faced the challenges of their day and had to live their lives and face the issues of identity and tradition and culture and all that it meant to them in preserving the faith in their time. And Father, may we understand the dangers of the days in which we live, the attack upon the traditions of faith in family and in church and community, and what that is, the havoc that is having in so many people's lives. And Father, we just pray your blessing upon us as we continue to find our way. And may you give us wisdom for each battle, each and also each opportunity that we might continue to seek your face. We ask in the name of Christ. Amen.